we get signal. My screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces.
Dat, ik moet nu beginnen?
Ja.
Ik hoor alleen muziek nu.
Wat?
Ik hoor alleen muziek nu.
You're on the air.
Oh, shit. Good evening, this is Hacktivism Hour with Walter. We have GMC in the studio on the doing the technical stuff. And we have Chris Kay from Telecomics on Skype. As well as Mari McCarthy from the Icelandic Media Initiative. Welcome aboard, guys.
Thanks.
Let's just start. The theme of the conversation tonight will be open data and privacy. But first, something entirely different. According to La Civiltà Cattolica, a Roman Catholic newspaper published by the Vatican, being a hacker is highly compatible with the Roman Catholic view on life. So apparently, according to the Vatican, you can hack yourself into heaven. Well, that's my interpretation. But the creative approach to technology is apparently comparable to a Christian walk of life. And on that bombshell, I think we must hear some music. The song is called Chains by Sheer. Okay, that was Sheer from their album Eve, the song Change. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. And let's just kick off by asking Chris the main question. Chris, what do you think how open data and privacy can be reconciled?
Well, I think that the whole notion of open data and privacy, and this question has been a question for a long time, before the internet even. And I think that it's different from each country and each culture, the way you handle this distinction on what should be in the public sphere and what should be kept in a private sphere. And with the internet and the widespread evolution of the World Wide Web, we have now a kind of a new technological opportunity to handle data. And for good and for bad reasons, we have new technologies of surveillance, which are extremely good at handling private data and public data. And we have community technologies that are also very good at crunching numbers and organizing information. And then we have kind of a third actor here, and that's when data that is not supposed to be in the public sphere all of a sudden leaks into the public sphere. So data that are supposed to be closed are made open data by different kind of leak sites and leaks in general. And I think that there are good and bad developments. I mean, the surveillance that we see and all the use of our data that are being kind of used by Google and Facebook, that's one way of handling data that are usually considered to be private but are used for semi-public or corporate interests. And then we have, for example, governments that are participating and sometimes very generously with providing open data, open access to government data and so forth. And then we have people who wish that this never happened and that data needs to be protected even more. So I'm thinking about we are in a position in history right now where we have to negotiate and discuss where these limits are being drawn by an intrusive technology, which would be, for example, our cell phone, where we give off data without really making a consent about it. And then we have the technologies of databases and so forth to provide a critical investigation into how governments are doing and so forth. And I think that today is the day where we have to decide where to draw the lines, which data to make and which data not to make, and how data should be kept. So yeah, that's my general kind of questions that I put to this notion of open data versus privacy, or and privacy maybe is the proper way of putting it.
Okay, and Smari, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I tend to take a kind of maybe a bit weird approach to the idea of privacy, because I think that in order, you know, a lot of people go around talking about privacy and not necessarily meaning privacy, but hiding things that should be public knowledge. So my approach is to say, what is privacy for? What purpose does it serve? And I generally think that privacy should serve the purpose of protecting the physical security of an individual, or protecting his social status, assuming he has a right to have that social status if he hasn't been a bad person or that kind of thing. So then comes kind of the question of, okay, how does it fit in with open data and that kind of thing? Well, it's a simple test. It can be developed very easily. If the information is likely to harm an individual, then maybe it should be kept private, but otherwise it should be open. And that's a fairly simple approach. Then comes maybe the other aspect of what's happening with privacy online. And we see all these new spaces coming up, all these social networks and such, but there seems not to be any discussion about whether sites like Facebook are supposed to be like public spheres, like a townhouse square, or whether it's supposed to be more like a nightclub or even like a house party. You know, there's different senses of privacy that need to be explored there.
Touching upon a dimension of privacy, which you do not explicitly acknowledge, but by mentioning your Facebook example, the issue most people have with Facebook, it's about mixing context. And my personal opinion, I'm getting back to asking you guys questions, but I want to ventilate my own opinion as well, is that privacy is mostly about the autonomy as an individual on how I am in different contexts. So if I end up having a Facebook account with photographs of me puking drunk in the gutter because of my student's years, I don't even have a Facebook account though. I don't want those photographs to be end up as part of a job interview procedure for a government job, for example. To have my mom see them because they raised me as a teetotaler and failed a bit at that. So privacy is more than just guarding your social status. It's we're different persons at home, we're different persons in love, we're different persons at work, we're different persons in hackerspaces. And to a certain extent, we can separate them. But I also would like to get back to Chris. Chris, you mentioned that is a cultural issue, but privacy is supposed to be a fundamental human right, which is inalienable. And all three of us are civilized Europeans under the European Convention of Human Rights.
Yes, but even within Europe, there are many cultural differences. I mean, in Sweden is a prime example of where you are born with an ID number, and this ID number is heavily used in by both the state, for example, the medical care and so forth, and but also anyone can just find out about your personal ID number and then can go to the tax authorities and find out how much money you earn. And these personal ID number is a centralization of different databases that is not considered to be okay in, for example, Germany, where you have a very different sense of what is the role between the individual and the state. In Sweden, we accept very much that the state has, you know, so much data about us. But in Germany, for historical reasons, people say, well, this is crazy. So I think that even within Europe and in different countries, we have different views on who is going to have data about me. And I think that so there is a cultural difference. I think that the fundamental right has to be negotiated. But what we see with Facebook and what we see is with these new actors, the different social media that have entered the scene, is that there are really no rules. I mean, and the rules don't really apply because Facebook is not based in Sweden. They are not under Swedish jurisdiction, and it's very
rules
hard for me
don't
to
apply.
Well, there are of course, yeah, there are rules, but the thing is, it's a question of autonomy. I mean, the autonomy of context that you spoke about, it's very different because I don't have the autonomy to choose when my data is going to be deleted properly from Facebook. And I don't have the autonomy is not there because the U.S. Homeland Security can file a subpoena and have my data, and so the autonomy is very low when it comes to these new forms of media.
But you can just not be on Facebook, can't you?
Yes, that's true, and it's much easier not to be on Facebook, but. Not being I mean, if I don't want to be a Swede anymore, I have to kind of return my passport or something, move out.
On that note, I live in Iceland, and there about 97% of all adults are on Facebook.
So not being on Facebook in Iceland is a very powerful form of social exclusion, which just isn't really available to everybody. A lot of people are kind of forced into these contexts where, I mean, the international context is a very important one here. The fact that Facebook isn't actually liable to, or at least not really enforceably liable to Swedish law or Dutch law or Icelandic law or whatever, they're always under the idea of American-style privacy, which is very vague and very brittle. So there's absolutely different contexts in here.
And actually, I was trolling you too, Ben, when I said you can't be on Facebook, because actually you can't. The lovely Facebook application for the iPhone, for example, uploads your complete address book if you have a Facebook account and use the Facebook iPhone app, and probably all the same for the Android app. And I'm rather sure some of my friends and family have a Facebook account, do have an iPhone, and do use the Facebook iPhone app. So probably Facebook has data on me without me ever having had an account with them.
And I think that one interesting thing, which also is about the different cultures of privacy, is the Iceland case of the Human Genome Project, which is a database of the genome of the Icelandic population. Now, I think that today this that database could not exist in every country in the world. It's the Icelandic case, I think, is very interesting in that respect.
It's all part of a hidden scheme to clone Björk, of course. But
I'm currently, like, my meat buddy is in Hungary at the moment, and I was showing somebody this database because every Icelander has access to this genealogical database and can compare, like, figure out how they're related to everybody. And you know, there was a sense of mild shock, just the fact that we actually share this kind of information with each other. But for in the Icelandic context, it's completely natural, if a bit weird at first. But
yeah, that's it's indeed strange that they have a complete country. And I think we should get back after some music about the argument about exclusion. And by some providence, we found the perfect song, which is called "Part of the Group" by the group Data Fail, but well, let's go ahead then.
It is nice to fit in, it is nice to blend in, it's nice to be a part of the motion, not alone. It looks nice to step in, feels right to join in, it lies within your soul and you can't fight it alone. Purpose, conformist, still, if it's gonna be part of your brain.
Welcome back to the show. We're just discussing, an important topic. It was brought up by Samari. To what extent can you actually opt out of social networking nowadays? And Chris?
Well, I think that you have the, you're free not to be a part of the social networks, of course. I mean, you don't have to have a, nobody is forcing you to have a Facebook account or a Twitter account. But then again, communication and communicating with the world is, of course, that's something that you want to do. And then if you, especially people who are not hackers, they go to, they use the services provided by different types of corporations. And so I think that once you want to communicate, you don't have much choice initially if you don't have the knowledges. So that means that people are, in a way, forced to use centralized services owned and by the different types of corporations. Now, of course, these services can be made much better. I mean, we have seen with Diaspora and different projects like that, that want to kind of make a better protocol for people to use. Even though these services are easy to use, they can be much more distributed and or decentralized. And I think that once we start to talk about these issues in the public sphere, we can put pressure, and not so much put pressure on Facebook, because I don't think that Facebook will change their business model, but rather to encourage the development of much better protocols for social media.
I'd like to hear Samari's opinion on that as well, of course, and also throw in a comment made on IRC and the Telecomics IRC network by some guy called XOR or Girl. Who says that simple services that don't require knowledge by the user are always centralized services. And I think he may have a point there. Hardly anyone uses Diaspora right now.
Oh, but that's not necessarily true, because the phone system is not entirely centralized. We have different phone providers in different countries and that kind of thing. So perhaps what we're saying is that there has been a great centralization of services on the internet, especially since the end of the bubble in 2001 and the advent of Ajax and Web 2.0 and all that stuff. There's been a great tendency towards centralization and further monetization and network effects and that kind of thing. And the companies that are doing this have gotten away with it by implementing very interesting lock-in mechanisms. There's like Facebook until very recently didn't have any way of communicating from outside the system. You had to log into the system. Now it is possible to send the emails to Facebook users through the typical email system, username@facebook.com. But I mean, that's kind of too little too late, and it isn't actually a protocol that is exporting the entire functionality. So the stuff that Diaspora is doing is very important in the fact that it is trying to federate services. And as long as people get the feeling that it is at least as simple as using a telephone, and they can access all of the same level of services as they have on Facebook, then I don't think that the average user will be worried about having to have extra knowledge. It kind of comes down to user interface aspect at that point.
Yeah, usability is a thing. On the other hand, if people do already have part of the network on Facebook, actually some friends of mine are nagging me to come aboard on Facebook, and I'm still resisting because I want to be different. Not really. But you do have huge network effects, obviously. I mean, and to a certain extent, it has been replacing, for example, email. An acquaintance of mine overheard some teenagers explaining email to each other on the subway, and it was explaining, yeah, it's a bit like Facebook, but you don't have to be friends to send a message to each other.
Well, not even that. I mean, you also see, Twitter is being used instead of sending text messages nowadays. It all goes through this server. There's another application. I forgot the name, but it's really popular nowadays. It's run by some company, and once you use that to replace your text messaging, you automatically upload your contacts again to this one company, and even if I don't want to be known by this company, if a friend of mine uses it, I'm in his phone.
You're gone. So I think we've touched upon this subject several times before. The inadvertently disclosure of personal data by people you directly know. How can we prevent that in the future?
Well, I think that if you look at another technology, that of BitTorrent, there is it's a protocol which is it's very much decentralized, and you can use it in a technical sense. You can use it very easily to kind of distribute information without having a central node. But the network effect comes from certain big websites, such as the Pirate Bay, for example, which made the BitTorrent protocol very popular. And the thing is that the Pirate Bay is extremely centralized, but it doesn't have much of your personal data in it, or it doesn't really have the content data, because that's what you download in the torrent, the different files. So I think that maybe this is the solution, because people, they will always need one place to go, one website or one community, one forum or so forth. They don't want to search to find people. They need to one spot where they can find people. And I think that this kind of search moment, or the feature where you actually find people, can still be centralized, but then you just make sure that the data and the information is kept locally on your local computer. That's the optimal way of handling private data. You can keep it on your computer, you can keep your computer encrypted, and you can delete it securely if you want to. But once the data is on a server, then it's almost impossible to make sure that something is actually deleted when you want it deleted.
So
I'm actually not entirely sure I agree with the idea that everybody wants a central place to go, because anybody who's, you know, to take a horrible meat space example, anybody who's gone bar hopping knows that sometimes you just want to test different venues and see what's happening. The idea of centralization is only useful if the user interfaces kind of force you in that path. And, you know, user interfaces actually control a lot about how we think about the world. And, you know, going back in time a bit, there used to be these social websites like in the Netherlands were CU2, and in Finland there was Ikkaralleria. And, you know, these things were in a sense centralized, but at the same time they had very local contexts, and they were very cultural hotspots in a sense. And they often connected into IRC channels or that kind of thing. But, you know, why did they fail? What spelled the demise of these things? Was it just the fact that this big thing came along that was centralized and therefore better? Or was it the fact that they failed to grasp the importance of federation and networking, and they fail to improve their user interface and usability?
Well, the point is, apart from centralized free versus decentralized and having proper user interfaces, that so far this seems to be a fairly rapid replacement cycle of social networking fads. I mean, Friendster is gone. MySpace is dying. Does anyone ever go to MySpace anymore? It's all Facebook right now, but Facebook, given that they got that Morgan Stanley got shares in them, I think they're probably past their prime as well.
Yeah, but this is because of the business models. Because if you just want to make a small community, putting up a small community software on a web server is not very expensive, and you can run it for free, and you can do it without ads if you just make sure to invest I don't know, €20 a month to pay for a server. So making a small community is very easy if you have some skills. But the problem is the business model of Facebook and Twitter and so forth is a model of mass production, if you would have it like that. They need huge aggregates of data to be able to make these kinds of selling ads and making consumer behavior analysis and so forth. So this means that the not so big sites are disappearing because their business model is all based on the same assumption to get all the data into one central point and then sell it and crunch it and use it for different purposes. Now, the small communities don't have this business model, but still they are not becoming so popular. But maybe that's not entirely true either, because I think that I'm part of many different small communities, such as Telecomics, for example. And I think that what we have seen in the past 5 or even in the past 10 years is a huge explosion of internet users. I mean, still people from the 90s, they are still on IRC, they are still in small communities. But I think that the new users, they got into the internet and got online when everything was about these big businesses.
Well, it's funny though that you bring this up, because that kind of, I'm going to disagree with you, but then it proves that there are cultural elements there. I mean, we in the West hardly use IRC anymore. At least I still do, but I'm from the 90s. My first IRC session was in 1992, which makes me a really old fart around nowadays. And 10 years ago, I had a flatmate from Indonesia, and apparently Chinese people from Indonesia use IRC to chat with each other. Apparently that's the big thing over there. And there are quite a lot of Chinese and Indonesians around. And I was kind of surprised to see someone who was 10, 15 years younger than I was be on IRC. I didn't expect it for someone who had come of age in the web era to use IRC. So apparently there is more to IRC than there used to be. However, I would like to get back to... Smiley, what do you want to say?
I was just going to say, I mean, IRC is still by far the best mass communication system in terms of text. Instant messaging is great for point-to-point, like one-on-one communications, but for mass communications, IRC is still the winner. And just on the subject of business models, I read somewhere that Facebook is valued now at $80 billion, and they have 500 million users. So dividing that makes, if we just ignore all the network effect value, just think about what the value of each individual user is, that's about $160 per person. And, I think that I'm a bit more valuable than that. So,
I actually disagree. Not in the sense as a person. One of the reasons the telco bubble burst in 2001 was the massive difference in valuation of each subscriber, and we can easily translate that to a user. For example, a UMTS subscriber in Spain was valued about 10 to 15 euros per year, because that was paid for the frequency for the spectrum in Spain. Whereas a similar user was apparently worth over €300 per year, because that was paid in the spectrum auctions in the UK. And that caused massive uncertainty in the financial markets about the financial position of the telcos. And all of a sudden, money lending was not free for the telcos anymore. And poof, went the bubble. So I think that kind of proves €160 for a Facebook user. That's ridiculous. They're never going to make that amount of money on a single user.
That's so maybe we have a new bubble. Yeah.
Well,
the social networking bubble.
Yeah.
I, for one, can't wait for it to burst.
Yeah. Maybe it may still grow a bit, but €160 per user, it's just ridiculous. And on that note, I think we'll throw in some more music if we can get there.
Turn on, you're listening to the radio program about hackers places.
Okay, you're still listening to the Hacktivist Hour, and we just rudely cut short the song TV Tech Vision short mix by the artist Data Collaborate from the album TV Tech Vision. And apparently a short mix is a mix of almost 8.5 minutes. And well, on IRC, Bubble O mentioned that the bubbly music fit in the theme of the bursting bubble of the social network. I would still like to get back to the original theme of this session, and that is privacy and open data. And I'm going to ask Smari the big question. If we want government to release more and more data, shouldn't we take into account that especially when combining multiple data sets, maybe from different government agencies, you may end up inadvertently releasing more personal data than you originally intended to have?
It's definitely a risk, but it can be a very calculated risk. There's a great deal of government data that doesn't actually have anything to do with private people in general, and that's definitely being withheld, such as government spending data and map geographical data, that kind of thing, which I'm sure could, in theory, be correlated to some extent with private individuals. But, you know, I think that the question of open data just isn't at the point yet where we have to be worrying about exactly that. You know, that isn't really where we're at. Nobody's really talking about squashing up against the wall where we're asking, should we release correlated, like geographically correlated disease frequency data. Nobody's asking for that yet. When somebody does start asking about that, then we should definitely start worrying about the privacy risks. But between now and then, let's just focus on the big stuff. There's plenty of really juicy data out there that has no privacy concerns at all.
Well, before I get to Chris, you give a nice example. We had a veterinary disease called Q fever, I think it's a proper term in the Netherlands. And the government kind of refused to release any data on it. And it's a disease that also affects humans. And an open data activist correlated, got his hands on the data, put it into geodata to show people that infections were close to their places, but given this involved farm animals, most farms are just run by families, it also released personal data effectively. I think it was justified by the general health risk of this veterinary disease and only proved that the Ministry of Agriculture was hushing up a difficult situation. But nonetheless, there was a privacy issue there. And let's get to Chris.
Yes. I think that's a good example of what the internet and what computers do with the data that are quite harmless if they are just on a piece of paper or if they are in an analog medium. For example, if we take in Sweden, we have a government transparency act that dates back to the 1700s, actually, which says that, well, any individual can go to a government agency and get the data out of it. But there have been technology-related regulations about that. So, for example, if you want to request a document, then you have to wait a bit, and then you get it in a piece of paper. And if there is personal data on it, they have a black pen, and they have kind of deleted any sensitive data. But then the problem is when you take this data and you systematically put it on a Google map, for example, or if you make a database where you can cross-reference this data with other data, and all of a sudden you end up with something that is an aggregated privacy concern. So I think that I think that it's case specific. As you said, this case in Holland here could be justified because it's a health risk. But then again, the boundaries are not very very clear. And I think that I'm not sure that there is a good answer to that question. I mean, so But yes, technology changes data, definitely.
Well, one of the reasons I'm asking these questions is that right now open data is a bit of a hype, and after every hype there's a bit of a disappointment, and there will be detractors and people fighting against it, and I expect this to be one of the reasons people will try to prevent data from opening up. And Smari, you're very much into the opening up data, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I just had one thought, which is when we're talking about things like computer security or even physical security, there's always a question of not necessarily providing perfect security, but just making it economically infeasible for an attacker to cause damage. And maybe that is something that could be used at least in analogy for... for the issue of privacy in relation to open data, that you don't necessarily have to worry all that much about correlation as long as the correlation itself is really hard to do. Then, of course, against that, against my own point, is there's really big governments out there with lots and lots of really clever statisticians who could probably correlate things that that the general public couldn't do very easily. So, it is a question of balance. I think that the general threat assessment model for computer security might apply in some sense.
And but Chris, do you expect the government to be able to apply a sensible threat model?
Well, I think that we have to discuss what kinds of data that we want to be generated at all. If there is a, there is a problem if my medical journal is leaked for me personally, for example, and that should be avoided. But if we take, for example, the data retention directive, then you make log files about people's cell phones and so forth, and these are not public data; they are only there for the police. But if they leak for some reason, that could be devastating for certain individuals. So I think that it's also about the creation of data. I think that it's I'm all in for open data concerning the government and what government agencies are doing, and for many reasons also what corporations are doing. I think that we should make more data and make more useful data about these bodies. But for the individual, I think that we have to consider which data should we generate in the first place. Because once you generate data, then it becomes a matter of computer security in protecting it. And as we all know, there is no such thing as a perfect security system once you connect the computer to the internet. So it's about which are the data that we are going to have in our future societies. I think that less personal data and more and good and also good ways of finding the actual good data about the government. I mean, a government can also provide lots and lots of data, which is kind of useless. It just becomes a noise of data, and then you're drowning in data, and that could also be used to actually hide something. So I think that good data and avoid bad data, kind of.
Smari, what do you think? Enlarge the haystack so the needle can't be found, or just don't have any needles around?
I don't think we can eliminate all needles. Anybody who is ever flagged as a person of interest when going through an airport or for some reason attracts attention to himself is going to be a needle, and typically the haystacks aren't very, very large. Coming back to this question of cultural context, there's the idea of, in countries like the Nordic countries, Sweden, Iceland, etc., the sense of privacy we have is so weak. We have the exact same social identification system as Sweden, and these numbers are public knowledge. If you go to a video store, you can rent a video and you use this number, but somehow
our societies have kind of come to live with it. But at the same time, we do that because we haven't had the kind of problems that have arisen in Germany, in Eastern Europe, where this kind of identifying data has been used to actually just kill people. So I don't know. Maybe what we need to do is move in the direction culturally where we don't have to worry all that much about being killed. Then privacy itself might become an issue that resolves itself. But I mean, that's the easy thing to say. How do we do that?
Well, my answer is in the Netherlands prior to World War II, we had 50 years of peace, basically. And we were told a few days before the Germans invaded by our prime minister we could sleep tight at night because nothing would go wrong. And, well, then we ended up with the worst survival chances for being Jewish in all of Europe, including Poland, etc. So I feel that's a pacifist answer, and pacifists are the people who will plow with the shares they made out of search for those who didn't. But I digress. Chris, go ahead. A few minutes left.
And this is why I think that we really have to consider what databases we are making. I mean, there's nothing bad with it as long as you have a nice government, but you don't know which government you will have in the future. In Europe, we see right-wing extremists gaining power in the parliaments and so forth, and what they are going to do with the data, that you always have to ask the question, what would a dictator do with this data? And then you kind of, or what would be the worst use of this data? And then you can decide on if you're going to produce it or not. And I think that the Scandinavian or some of the Scandinavian countries have an extremely naive attitude towards this. I mean, it works, but then we don't know what happens when it fails.
Well, we don't know what happens when it fails, but even in Western Europe, we haven't learned our lesson because you brought up this social security-like identification number. We have the same thing in the Netherlands.
And yes, I mean, we can learn from history, but...
We don't.
No.
I think it's right. We do have a very naive sense of privacy in the Nordic countries and in Western Europe. But at the same time, you know, one time it's a particular social group that's singled out and led to slaughter. But you know, next time around, it might be something, you know, some dictator who just dislikes people who have had a certain type of, gone to a dentist for a certain type of procedure. And, you know, then it'll just be gather together dental records and figure out statistically who needs to be killed. So, you know, one of the factors is we don't know what information is going to be abused in the future.
Ginger has no soul, you know, for example.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So what will be the next thing? You know, maybe the approach to privacy needs to just be make sure that people don't feel a need to abuse it or abuse the data.
Yeah.
Again, it's a simple thing to say, but... You know, how to implement it.
I think we have to wrap up. And so far the conclusion, I think it has been inconclusive. And we may repeat this theme in the future. But the thing I'm taking back from this is we have to combine two memes. One is, what would Jesus do? And you know, else who would think about this? So basically, what would Hitler do with your data is the big question. And on that slightly depressing note, I think it's time for our closing song, and it's by some artist or group called Project System 12, and the song is, bloody hell, way too long a title, Diving Through the Clouds, which I think is actually another nice theme, privacy in the cloud, maybe for the future. The song is Diving Through the Clouds by Project System 12, and I have no idea where they're from, but thank you for joining and listening, and till next time.